and by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store. Strawberry Fields offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, and pet foods. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
It's 1240. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. Illinois lawmakers began November with an election that solidified Democratic majorities. They will finish the month back at the Capitol. And although it is technically a veto session, we could look for more to pop up as well. Amanda Vinicky has a preview.
It's called veto session because it's when the General Assembly is supposed to consider legislation the governor rejected or changed. Theoretically, at least, legislators will deal with measures nixed by Governor Pat Quinn, including statewide regulation of plastic bags and a plan to let cancer treatment centers reject job applicants who smoke. But with the shackles of campaigning just removed, especially for legislators who won't be back next session, it's a ripe time for votes on a range of contentious policies.
It's going to be a very rough session.
Anti-gambling activist Anita Bedell.
Because there are so many lame ducks, who don't have anything to lose by voting on gambling.
Bedell spent the week of Thanksgiving asking gambling opponents to call their legislators. She predicts they might try to override Quinn's veto of a plan that would give casinos to Chicago and four other towns, including Danville and Rockford. On the other hand, Quinn might be backing off his stance that he wouldn't tolerate slot machines at horse race tracks. So rather than try to go around him, legislators may instead work with him to pass a whole new bill. Either way, Bedell says she's seen it before. The end of session is when legislators try to ram through controversial proposals.
Whenever they think they can get it through quickly, that's when they run the bill.
What has Bedell on edge has Dan Lynn excited. He heads Illinois Normal, the national organization to reform marijuana laws, a group that has tried for roughly a dozen years to legalize marijuana for medicinal use. It's come close, but no cigar. Now,
we're as optimistic as we've ever been.
It's cautious optimism.
Unfortunately, we've been confident and optimistic before, and there's no guarantee in politics that this will even get brought up in the veto session.
Lynn says this year's different. The measure scaled back to a three-year pilot program, and because the conversation nationally is changing. Colorado voters just legalized pot for recreational use. Likewise, the election saw four states support same-sex marriage. Emboldened by that evidence of a shift in public opinion, advocates are making a push to approve gay marriage in Illinois. Democratic Representative Greg Harris of Chicago, who sponsored Illinois' civil unions law, acknowledges momentum, but he's not rushing down the aisle of the House just yet.
I take this seriously. When I call it for a vote, I want to be sure it passes. This is not something that, I would call frivolously.
Harris says there are so many other pressing issues on the agenda, he doesn't know if there's time to get it done. One that appears to be on the fast track, driver's licenses for immigrants who are here illegally. And with President Barack Obama still in the White House, it looks like his signature health care act is here to stay. Legislators in his home state are getting ready to implement it. That's sure to be controversial, too, pitting insurance companies and business groups against advocates like Jim Duffett of the Illinois Campaign for Better Health Care, who says with the election over,
there's no longer any excuses for politicians on both sides of the aisle not to move forward and implement Obamacare.
None of these get to the heart of arguably the biggest issues in Illinois, pensions and the budget overall. There's talk of veto session votes to put more money into education, to refinance the state's debt, or even to extend the temporary income tax hike. It's a blockbuster agenda, but like reporters, legislators have a habit of procrastinating until deadline. If measures aren't taken up this week, there's also a second week of veto session in early December, and the current General Assembly is scheduled to return again at the start of the new year. They can vote right up until new legislators are sworn in, meaning there's plenty of time left before the so-called lame duck legislators fly away. I'm Amanda Vinicky.
The city of Baltimore boasts an amazing inner harbor, lots of John Waters fans, references to Edgar Allan Poe, and thousands of abandoned houses. It also has one of the nation's most comprehensive programs to clean them up. It focuses on selling houses in neighborhoods near key employers and other attractions and demolishes buildings in less viable areas of the city. But the plan requires government officials to make some hard choices about which neighborhoods are worth saving. For member station WYPR in Baltimore, Maryland, Stephanie Hughes has this report.
It's not every open house that begins with the signing of a liability waiver.
You know, we encourage you to be careful, you know, safety. You know, if you feel unsafe, please come out immediately.
Okay.
You know.
I'm going to suggest not going in too far, just for safety purposes.
Nikki Cooper and Teresa Stevens are advising potential homebuyer Stephanie Gaynor before she enters a vacant home for sale in Northwest Baltimore. Gaynor came prepared.
I've got a flashlight and I've got shoes that can take the mud because it's raining. I was going to bring a can of bug spray, but it looks like we're good.
The building is available through the city's Vacants to Value program, and it's the sort of place that looks like it could be harboring bugs. The home has been empty a while, with a boarded-up door. And in the back, what may have once been a kitchen, is now missing a wall.
I mean, a lot of people probably look at it and think, an abandoned home. That's what it is. It's an abandoned home. But it's a big home. I love the yard. I love the trees.
The house where Gaynor might one day live is what city officials call an emerging market, with only a few vacant buildings. In those communities, and in areas next to major developments, like Johns Hopkins Hospital, the city is focused on getting the vacants fixed up and occupied. The rest? Here's Julie Day of Baltimore City Housing.
We probably have about 10,000 buildings that we need to demolish. Those are intractable blight in blocks that are just not, you know, structurally viable, or there's just no foreseeable time when there will be a market.
Those sorts of choices are difficult for the city to make. It's hard to tell residents that their neighborhood isn't going to improve. Demolition is also expensive, requiring more than $165 million, which Baltimore just doesn't have. But this strategic approach has been identified by the Brookings Institution as a good one, because it provides a plan for every structure, even if the plan is to knock it down. For the places left standing, the city hosts workshops on what it takes to restore these buildings.
What's the rehabilitation process been like?
Expensive, but it's worth it.
40-year-old Rob Moore is a future landlord. He was at a recent workshop on permits. At these events, the marketing team wants the public to see the possibilities in the vacants. So they hand out actual rose-colored glasses, along with advice for new homeowners.
In the long run, somebody's going to have a nice, warm home. I bought these rehabs to make money, and investing in these properties will, in the long run, make somebody else happy. I know I will be a good homeowner.
2 years into the program, about a tenth of the city's vacants have been rehabilitated or are on their way. Though it may be slow going, people like Moore say it's necessary work.
I think the vacants paint a picture of what the city is, you know, a broken down city. The sooner that the vacants are taken care of, I think people will start to take Baltimore more serious.
To plan for this serious future, Baltimore needs to attract people who are actually dreamers, those who are able to envision a different version of the city, even without a pair of rose-colored glasses. For NPR News, I'm Stephanie Hughes in Baltimore.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois. Blood donations decrease at holiday time, but patient need remains the same year-round. There are no substitutes for donated blood, and donation takes only 45 minutes. Blood donation, it's about life. More information is at 367-2202.
Even wealthy universities now want more students who can pay their own way. Schools say rising financial aid costs are hurting education quality.
We don't get in a room and say, okay, do we give more aid here or do we give a raise to our professor over here? But behind the curtain, that's what's happening.
Colleges rethink financial aid later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 27th of November, 2012. It was on this day, 1786, the poet Robert Burns borrowed a pony and made his way from his home in Ayrshire to the city of Edinburgh. He was a failure at farming,
And after he got his girlfriend Jean Armour pregnant, he decided he needed to find a way to support the new family. He already had an illegitimate one-year-old daughter whose mother was a servant in the Burns household, and she wanted some money. So he accepted a friend's offer to go to work in the Caribbean as a clerk in Jamaica, and he was all set to leave in September. A few weeks before his departure, he published poems chiefly in the Scottish dialect, hoping to raise enough money to pay his fare. And the book became so successful that Burns began to doubt that he should leave Scotland. And then Jean Armour gave birth to twins. And at the same time, Burns heard that his book of poems had been favorably received by some influential critics in Edinburgh. And so, full of hope, he borrowed the pony. He made the two-day trip to Edinburgh. Along the way, he was entertained by farmers who had heard about him and who wanted to take him in for the night and to give big feasts in his honor. And he arrived in Edinburgh to find out that he was now famous in Scotland, and the trip to Jamaica was canceled. It's the birthday of the historian Charles A. Beard, born Knightstown, Indiana, 1874, who argued in his book An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution that the Founding Fathers wrote the Constitution as a way to protect their own economic interests more than for any ideological reasons. And he also saw the Civil War not as a war that was about slavery, but as a conflict between the agricultural economy of the South and the industrialized economy of the North. It's the birthday of James Agee, born in Knoxville, 1909, best remembered for his autobiographical novel A Death in the Family and his account of Southern sharecroppers during the Dust Bowl, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. But during his life, he was best known as a film critic for The Nation and for Time magazine. And it's the birthday of the filmmaker Les Blank, born in Tampa, 1935, studied English, wanted to be a writer. Everything he wrote was rejected. He stayed in graduate school, wanted to become a teacher, but then his marriage failed, and he didn't feel like studying anymore. He dropped out, couldn't find a job doing anything, and then he saw a film by Ingmar Bergman, The Seventh Seal, and it changed his life. He decided to become a filmmaker. Les Blank has made more than 40 films, many of them documentaries about different traditional musicians, Cajun music.